be turning to Isaiah chapter 7, and I will intend to take only chapter 7 and chapter 8 tonight, only two chapters tonight. And if we do that in less than the time that we've allotted, we still won't go on because I want to take chapters 9 through 12 as a unit next time. So we will study tonight chapters 7 and 8. Now, the first six chapters of Isaiah we have called opening prophecies. And I guess that's because we know that Isaiah's ministry traversed the reigns of four kings, Uzziah and Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah. And the sixth chapter begins with the death of Uzziah. Now, we've studied that already, but it was in the year that Uzziah died. Now, Uzziah is the first of the four kings mentioned during whose reigns Isaiah prophesied and lived. So, it would mean the beginning of Jotham's reign that chapter 6 took place. And it would seem that the prophecies of chapters 1 through 5 would have been prophesied during the years of Uzziah before his death, if we can assign any kind of a chronological arrangement to the prophecies. It would seem that chapters 1 through 5 were uttered during the reign of Uzziah. Chapter 6 takes place at the death of Uzziah, which would be the beginning of the reign of Jotham, though there's no actual prophecies per se that really belong to the period of Jotham, except for the opening call of Isaiah in chapter 6. And now we've jumped over the reign of Jotham altogether in chapter 7, and we come to the reign of Ahaz, the third of the four kings, in whose reign Isaiah prophesied. Ahaz was unlike Uzziah and Jotham. He was a bad king. Yet God spoke well to him because he was God's agent in Judah, God's leader over God's people. And the chapter 7 begins a new section of prophecies, and we could call these prophecies related to Emmanuel. Emmanuel is the Hebrew word, means God with us. The name appears a couple of times or three during this section. The section is from chapters 7 through 12. And after that, a new section of the book begins. So chapters 7 through 12 make up a section which I have called Prophecies of Emmanuel, or related to Emmanuel. And so that's what we're going to begin tonight. And we'll start at verse 1 of chapter 7. It came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, the king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. And it was told the house of David, saying, Syria is confederate with Ephraim. And his heart was moved. That would be Ahaz's heart was moved. And the heart of his people, as the trees of the wood, are moved with the wind. Now, this setting is taken from 2 Kings chapter 16. You don't have to turn there, but the story appears there, how that the king of Syria and the king of Israel, remember Israel was the northern kingdom, whereas Judah was the southern kingdom. We haven't come to that point in our studies in the Old Testament history yet, but after the days of Solomon, the kingdom divided into two. The northern kingdom was Israel, the southern kingdom Judah. This setting for this story is in Judah, where Isaiah lived and prophesied, in Jerusalem, the capital. And Israel, the northern kingdom, joined forces with Syria to come against Jerusalem. Now, the purpose of this was that all the small nations of that region at this time were being terrorized and threatened by a much larger empire called Assyria. And Assyria was swallowing up all the little kingdoms around by military expansion, a little bit like Babylon did later, and as Greece and Rome did in their own times. Assyria was the great advancing, spreading kingdom at this time, and so these little kingdoms of Syria and Israel and Judah were all threatened by Assyria. Now, what was the plot here? Israel and Syria wanted Ahaz, the king of Judah, to join with them in a threefold cord to resist Assyria. But Ahaz didn't feel very good about that. I suppose he didn't want to get Assyria angry at him for getting involved in a plot or a confederacy against them, so he refused. And so Syria and Israel, their two kings, decided to lead armies against Jerusalem to try to intimidate and persuade Ahaz to do what they want. In fact, not only to intimidate, if he didn't surrender, they planned to remove him and put another king on the throne who would be the son of Tibeel, it says in verse 6. The plot of these kings is mentioned in verse 6, is let us go up against Judah and vex it, and let us make a breach therein for us, and set a king in the midst of it, even the son of Tabeel. So whoever this son of Tabeel was, that's who they wanted to replace Ahaz with, because apparently this king that they would put in his place would be favorable to their intentions and would cooperate with them. Now, because Ahaz was resisting, he found himself besieged by these kings. And it says that the kings were these. Rezin was the name of the king of Syria. And Pekah, the son of Remaliah, was the king of Israel at the time. And these two came to make war against Jerusalem to get them to surrender and to go along with their plan. When the house of David heard about this, and of course this means the house of David's ancestors, the kings in Israel or in Jerusalem were all descendants of David. So when the king's house heard about it, they were of course very afraid. It says their hearts were moved, that is, they were shaking, trembling, like trees are moved with the wind. Then it says in verse 3, then said the Lord unto Isaiah, go forth now to meet Ahaz, thou and Shear Jashub thy son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. Shear Jashub, to whom we're introduced for the first time here, is Isaiah's first son. He had another one in the next chapter, whose birth is recorded, named Mahershal El Hashbaz. But Shear Jashub literally means the remnant shall return. And you might remember from chapter 6, in verse 13, after God told Isaiah that there was going to be a great emptying of the land through the captivity, and this looked forward actually to the Babylonian captivity, it says in verse 13 of chapter 6, but yet in it there shall be a tenth, and it shall return and be eaten as a tile tree, or teal tree, and as an oak whose substance is in them, when they cast their leaves, so shall the holy seed be the substance thereof. Now what he means by that is when the great exile takes place, there will be a remnant, signified by a tenth here, but not a literal tenth, rather a very small percentage, a very small remnant would remain. And the message of Isaiah was very much taken with this subject of the remnant. His first son was named Shear Jashub, which means the remnant shall return. And later on in chapter 10, we see this prophecy in verse 20 and 21. Well, we could just say 21 and 22. This is Isaiah 10, 21 and 22. The remnant shall return. That's the name of his son. Even the remnant of Jacob unto the mighty God. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness. So he says that though there are many Israelites, natural Israelites, numbering like the sands of the sea, yet only a very small remnant would return. So Isaiah's prophecy throughout his entire book, you will find a stress on this remnant. You'll find that the promises that God made to Israel are to be fulfilled only to that group of Israelites called the remnant. And the remnant, of course, are whatever Jews there were at a given time who were believers. And at any given time, there were some Jews who were not believers. And they were not the ones to whom the promises would be fulfilled, but those who were believers would be. And that might have been a large or small remnant at different times. In Elijah's day, we're told that the remnant consisted of 7,000 who had not bowed the knee to Baal. In Jesus' day, the remnant was consisted of about 12, or actually 11 at one point, which were the disciples that didn't betray him. So, really, the remnant could be very small or very large at different times, but Isaiah's prophecy gives us valuable information about this, because many times in reading the Old Testament, you'll have the impression that the nation of Israel as a whole has certain unconditional blessings that they are to receive, but in fact, the promises are made to the remnant, the faithful among Israel. And eventually, of course, in the days of Jesus, that remnant became the church. The early Christians were all of the Jewish remnant of that period, and later we Gentiles were included. At any rate, the reason I bring that up now is because we see his son Shear Jashub. His name itself means the remnant shall return. I might turn your attention for the moment also to chapter 8 and verse 18. where Isaiah says, "Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts which dwelleth in Mount Zion." Now he says, "I and the children that the Lord has given me are for signs and for wonders." It's not sure exactly how his children were signs and wonders, except that their birth and the names they received certainly bore a message. We will see that clearly in chapter 8. And obviously with the name Shear Jashub, that name carried a message. So that Isaiah's own name and the names of his children were for a sign, or for to convey a thought and a message. His message was not only uttered in words, but also embodied in his children and in the names that he gave them. Okay, now they were told, Isaiah and his son, Shear Jashub, were supposed to go together and meet Ahaz. I think it's neat that his son, who was probably quite young at this time, got to accompany him in his ministry. He got to be discipled hands-on. I get to go see how a prophet speaks to a king. And I think it's really good to take the kids out in evangelistic efforts and things so that they get to see how it's done. Too many times the kids are left at home while the parents go out and do all the work of the kingdom. I think at the earliest possible age they ought to be out seeing how it's done so they become familiar and at ease with the work of the ministry. Verse 4 is what they're supposed to say when they meet King Ahaz. "Say unto him, take heed and be quiet. Fear not, neither be faint-hearted for the two tails of these smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of reason with Syria, and for the son of Ramaliah. Because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Ramaliah have taken evil counsel against thee, saying, Let us go up against Judah and vex it. And let us make a breach therein for us, and set a king in the midst of it, even the son of Tabeel. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass." So he basically shares that God is aware of the turmoil that Ahaz is going through. He says, now be quiet. Now be quiet doesn't mean that he was being too noisy, but rather that he needs to be still. He needs to quiet his nerves. He needs to quiet his spirit before God and not be afraid. Not be faint-hearted for these two kings that are coming against him. God shows that he knows exactly what the enemy is thinking. He knows their conspiracy, and therefore it's nice to know that God knows the situation. You know, it's very comforting when you're in a trial just to remember that God is aware of it, even before he does anything about it. We sometimes feel like we're all alone in our troubles. I think the devil would like to convey that thought to us a lot of the time, that our trials are somewhat unique and we're alone in them and it's just going to have to be us against the world. But as soon as we remember that God knows the number of hairs on our head and not a sparrow falls to the ground without his knowledge and without his permission, and how much worth more than sparrows are we, it's very evident that when God is in touch with our situation, that it's very reassuring. I think that's one of the reasons that there's a gift in the church called the Word of Knowledge. Because ordinarily, as I understand that gift, it functions to convey to a person that God is aware of their secret life, that God is aware of their individual details of their life, and particularly the trials they're going through. And most of you probably have encountered the use of this gift sometimes in association with healing, where someone says, there's a person over here who has such and such a sickness, and that would, of course, give the person who's sick the realization, well, God knows about my sickness. God knows what I'm up against here. He knows my trial. And just the knowledge that he knows, in a sense, sparks faith that, well, if he knows and if he's bringing it to my attention, it must mean that he's going to do something about it. And so that's what we see here. He comes to Ahaz with that message, you know, tells him he says, I know what's going on. I know what these people are doing. I know what's going on in your heart. You're shaken. You're faint-hearted. Now don't be, because he says in verse 7, Thus saith the Lord God, it will not stand, neither shall it come to pass. Now Ahaz wasn't a good king, and God didn't owe him any favors. Nonetheless, out of God's grace, because it didn't happen to be God's purpose for Jerusalem to fall on this occasion, God assured this king, evil as he was, that God was going to stand with him and with his side on this occasion, and that those who were conspiring against him would have their purposes thwarted. In verse 8 it says, as Isaiah continues his message, For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is reason. And within 75 years shall Ephraim be broken, that it be not a people. Now, how is this prophecy to be understood, and how is it fulfilled? The head of Syria is Damascus, simply points out that Damascus is the capital of that nation. Damascus was the capital of Syria. And the head of Damascus is Rezin, simply says that the king of that city, of that capital city, is named Rezin. And within 65 years, that's 65 years, shall Ephraim be broken, that it be not a people. You might notice the use of the word Ephraim here. I should probably call attention to it. You might say, well, who's this Ephraim that comes up? We know about Judah, we know about Syria, we know about Israel, but who's Ephraim? Well, Ephraim was the largest of the tribes of the northern kingdom. Now, you might recall, and if you don't, I'll remind you, that when the kingdom divided, 10 of the 12 tribes confederated to the north, and 2 of the tribes remained in the south. The 2 in the south were Judah and Benjamin. But Judah was by far the larger and more significant of the 2 tribes. Benjamin was very small, and therefore the kingdom of the south was called Judah, named after the largest tribe. In the north, of the 10 tribes up to the north, by far the most influential and most significant and largest was the tribe of Ephraim, which was one of the half-tribes from the line of Joseph. And Ephraim was so significantly larger and more powerful than the others that it was sometimes substituted for the name Israel. As the southern kingdom was called Judah, though there was also the tribe of Benjamin, so the northern kingdom was sometimes called Ephraim. And you can see here how that the terms are used interchangeable, for instance, even between verses 1 and 2. When it talks about in verse 1 how the king of Israel came up, and then in verse 2 it says, the rumor went through Jerusalem, Syria is confederate with Ephraim, which is substituted for the name Israel. So don't be confused by that. Sometimes it's just for the sake of poetic variety, rather than having to hear the same word over and over again, the writer will substitute one name or the other. And so when it says in verse 8 that within 65 years Ephraim shall be broken, that it be not a people, you might be interested in knowing how this was fulfilled. First of all, if we're going to measure 65 years, we need to know where the starting date is. And the starting date is apparently from the time this prophecy was uttered. When was that? This prophecy was uttered in 735 B.C. As I said, the story of it is found in 2 Kings chapter 16, 735 B.C. Now, 2 Kings 16? What happened is there's three things involved in the fulfillment of this prophecy. One is that Tiglath-Pileser came in 2 Kings 15. Yeah, 2 Kings 15. Let's look there. There's three events that were instrumental in the absolute final fulfillment of this prophecy. Second Kings 15, verse 29. Says, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and took Ijon and Abel-Beth-Maacah and Jaanoah and Kedesh and Hazer and Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and carried them captive into Assyria. Now this is what happened to Israel in the days of Pekah. Remember, Pekah is the same king of Israel that came against Ahaz on this occasion in Isaiah. In 2 Kings 16 and verse 9, it says, and the king of Assyria hearkened unto him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus, that's of course the capital of Syria, and took it, and carried the people of it captive to Kir, and slew Rezin. Now there's Rezin and Pekah, the two kings who came against Ahaz. Both of them get their just deserts from the king of Assyria, the one that they were trying to get Judah to band with them against. Tiglath-Pileser was the king of Assyria, and he finally defeated both of them. After that point, in 2 Kings 17, in verse 6, it says, in the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Assyria, took Samaria. Hoshea, the king of Assyria, took Samaria and carried away into Assyria and placed them in Hala and in Habor by the river of Gozan in the cities of Medes. Now here, you see in the previous place we read about, he came and he He took some of the cities and carried the cities away captive to Assyria. But that wasn't a complete destruction of the northern kingdom. Now later, in chapter 17 and verse 6, he came and carried away even the king of Israel. And that, of course, was the end of that kingdom. And then even later, in 2 Kings 17:24 says, the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, from Cutha, and from Ava, and from Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria. Samaria now was the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. Instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. Now, what this says is that after the king of Assyria vacated the cities of Israel, after he defeated them, he brought in people from other countries to fill their space, so that the land was repopulated with totally different ethnic groups. And these were the people who later became known as the Sumerians in Jesus' day, who actually intermarried with whatever Jews there were, and there were half-breed Jew-Gentile mixed in that day in Samaria when Jesus lived, and that's why the Samaritans were hated so much by the Jews, because they hadn't retained their pure Jewish ethnic blood. But the point here is that these three things, that is, Tiglath-Pileser wiping out Rezin and Pekah, then the taking away of the king on another occasion that we read of in chapter 17 and verse 6, and then later the replacing of the Israelites by peoples from other lands in the land of Israel, this actually caused this Ephraim to be broken, that it be not a people. And that happened in 669 B.C. The last of these events happened in 669 B.C. And you can see that that's just 65 years after the time that this prophecy was uttered. 669, this was fulfilled. The prophecy was uttered in 735, or some say 734. At any rate, it's about 65 or 64 years. So, you can see that the prophecy was quite on the mark. It says, within 65 years, that's 65 years, shall Ephraim be broken, that it be not a people. Verse 9, Isaiah 7, 9. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If ye will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Now this is the message to Ahaz. He is given a comforting word that his enemies are going to be destroyed within 65 years. However, that doesn't really tell him a whole lot about the immediate circumstances. I mean, at the moment he was besieged. Now God did say in verse 7 that it was the conspiracy against him was not going to be successful. And he did say what their ultimate doom would be in 65 years, though King Ahaz probably didn't expect to live another 65 years to see it, so that would be a questionable comfort. But the point is here, he was supposed to believe this. He's supposed to believe that God's judgment was going to be on his enemies and that God was going to stand by him on this occasion. So if you don't believe, you won't be established, or as the marginal reading says, do you not believe? It is because you're not stable. Either reading could be true. And Ahaz didn't believe, as it turns out in verse 10. Moreover, the Lord spake unto Ahaz, saying, ask thee a sign of the Lord thy God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Lord. And he said, hear ye now, O house of David. Is it a small thing for you to weary men, but will ye weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken by both of her kings. Now, part of this prophecy is quite familiar to us. Another part is not very familiar to us, and the part that's not familiar almost makes us wonder about the interpretation of the part that is. He says, since King Ahaz tended to be kind of an unbeliever, God offered him, magnanimously offered to give him any sign that he asked for. Ask me a sign, just name it. Anything in the earth, in the heaven, you name it. And Ahaz says, I'm not going to ask the Lord. I'm not going to tempt God. Well, in some circumstances, if you're making demands on God that are unreasonable, and which he is not disposed to do, and you're saying, well, God, you have to do this for me, like jumping off a pinnacle of the temple and saying, God, you have to send your angels to catch me, that is tempting God. Jesus, when he was tempted to do that very thing, told Satan, it is written, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. to put yourself in a situation by your own choice and require that God come to your aid is something that is said to be tempting God. But on this occasion, to ask for a sign was not a matter of tempting God. God had told him to do it, and therefore it was just a matter of obedience. And the man, simply because he didn't believe, refused to ask for a sign. He gave it a religious-sounding excuse. I don't want to tempt God. But really, the real problem was that he didn't believe. And that's why God was weary with him. He says, it's a small thing for you to weary man, but are you also going to weary God? You know, is God getting weary with you? Why don't you just cooperate? And so God says, okay, you're not going to ask for a sign. I'll choose a sign. And the sign that he gives in verse 14 is a verse that is quite familiar to us because it's quoted in the New Testament. Therefore, the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin. In the Hebrew, it's the virgin, literally. The virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, we know that this verse is quoted in the New Testament about Jesus Christ. It is a prophecy, I believe, that has a double fulfillment, however, and I'll tell you why I think that as we go back to Isaiah in a moment. But let's look at Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1. After it tells how the angel appeared to Joseph and told him that Mary's unborn child was conceived by the Holy Spirit and that she was in fact still a virgin, though she were pregnant. In Matthew 1, 22 and 23, it says, Now all this was done that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel. There's the quote from Isaiah 7, 14. But Matthew adds, which being interpreted is God with us. He stresses the meaning of the name Emmanuel. Emmanuel literally means God with us. Now, that means, of course, that this prophecy speaks of Jesus Christ. There are, however, some things about the passage that make us wonder how it is that it speaks of Jesus Christ. For one thing, we might ask, how in the world could the birth of Jesus Christ, which was not to take place for another 735 years after this, be considered a sign to Ahaz? Since he would not live to see it. He was not going to live another 735 years, and therefore the birth of Jesus Christ could hardly be seen as a sign to Ahaz, and yet it is said that God said, the Lord will give you a sign. Now, some argue from this, well, the sign is not to Ahaz personally, but to the house of David. In verse 13, he said, Hear ye now, O house of David, and that it is the house of David which is to get the sign. Now, the house of David, we saw, is a term that's used earlier in the same chapter with a reference to Ahaz's family and the royal family. In verse 2, it says it was told to the house of David, saying Syria is confederate. So, to me, the house of David would speak of the dynasty of kings that followed in David's line. When Jesus was born, there were no such kings in Israel. There was no such house of David at the time that Jesus was born. And it does seem like Isaiah is speaking of a sign to Ahaz, that Ahaz could see and could get a message from. And what is the message he would get? Look at verses 15 and 16. About this child that would be born, it says, Butter and honey shall he eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that thou abhorrest shall be forsaken of both the kings. Now, what does it mean, both her kings? In the context, it's almost certain he's talking about Pekah and Rezin. He has just said in verse 8 that both of these kings are going to be broken within 65 years. So it does seem as though these are the two kings that are in mind. But what does it mean about this child who will eat butter and honey until he knows to refuse evil and choose the good? And before the child reaches that age, these two kings will have been removed from the scene. Well, butter and honey shall he eat until this time probably means that the child will not be weaned until this time. That is, he might eat such soft things as butter and honey, you know, milk products and honey, although actually babies under a year old shouldn't have honey, we now know, but that doesn't mean they never gave it to them in those days. And the child was not to be weaned until these kings were out of the picture. And to add to the image, says he won't have a moral consciousness. He won't know to choose the good or refuse the evil until this time. So he speaks of a time in the maturing of this child that is to be born. at the time the child is weaned, and at the time that that child has some awareness of moral realities, whenever that is, when he reaches some kind of age of accountability, by the time he reaches that, these two kings are going to be long gone, out of the picture. Okay? Well, that could refer to the birth of Jesus, but it does seem a little bit overstating the case. I mean, since the kings were gone 700 years before Jesus even was born, it seems unnatural to say, before he's weaned, they'll be gone. It would make a lot more sense to us if it was speaking of a close-range situation of a child that was soon to be born and whose birth would be assigned to Ahaz and Ahaz could see, okay, this child is born. Now, within the time it takes for this child to be weaned is the time that I'll be tormented by these kings, but they'll be gone before that time. In other words, it would be giving him some kind of a short-range hope of being delivered out of the hand of these kings. That's what I believe this is about. And it has an application, obviously, to Jesus, too. We know that from the New Testament. But is there a short-range fulfillment of the prophecy? Now, some people think there's only one fulfillment of a given prophecy. And some great scholars believe that. I don't agree with them. I think that there are a number of prophecies that have a short-range and a long-range fulfillment. A double fulfillment, in other words. For instance, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, Nathan told David that God would raise up one of his sons, one of his seed, to sit on his throne after him, who would build a house unto the name of the Lord. And God would establish his kingdom forever. Well, Solomon, in the short range, seemed to fulfill that somewhat, because Solomon was a son of David. He did sit on David's throne after him, and he did build a house. He did build a temple. And God did establish his throne at least all the days of his life. But there was a long-range fulfillment of that in view, and that is, of course, in Christ. Jesus was the long-range fulfillment of that prophecy that Nathan gave to David, whereas Solomon was a short-range fulfillment. And there are many prophecies like this. I think this is one of them. I think the child that is spoken of here, it makes reference to a short-range fulfillment that happened in Isaiah's and Ahaz's time, and I'll point out what I think the fulfillment was. But it also looked forward to a greater fulfillment. Now, what child did it look to in the short range? Let's turn to chapter 8 for a moment. We'll get back to the rest of chapter 7 in a moment. But let me turn your attention to chapter 8 and verse 1. Moreover, the Lord said unto me, take thee a great roll, and write in it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalel Hashbaz. Now the name Maher Shalel Hashbaz means making speed to the spoil, he hasteneth to the prey. Long name. The interpretation is long, and the name itself is long. But it has to do with the fact that the Assyrians are going to come and make haste to the spoil, that is, to destroy Israel and Syria. And so he says, write about this man. He says, and I took unto me the faithful witnesses to record, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah, and I went unto the prophetess, and she conceived, and bare a son. Then said the Lord to me, call his name Maher Shalel Hashbaz. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. The Lord spake unto me also, saying, forasmuch as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloah that go softly, and rejoice in reason and Remaliah's son, now therefore behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory, that he shall come up over all his channels, and go over all his banks, and he shall pass through Judah, and shall overflow, and go over, and he shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. Then he says, associate yourselves, O ye people, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Give ear, all ye far countries. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and be ye broken in pieces. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand, for God is with us, which is what Emmanuel means. Now, what is this talking about? Okay, it begins with Isaiah being instructed to go into a prophetess. We presume it is his wife, because she bears a son by him, and while it doesn't say she is his wife, now, we realize that sometimes moral standards were a little different in the Old Testament than under the Christian dispensation, and that sometimes good men even had concubines and all. I don't know whether Isaiah here had a concubine, and that is why she's not called his wife, or whether she was just his legal wife and she also happened to be a prophetess. It is mentioned specifically that Jeremiah was commanded not to marry, and that Ezekiel's wife died. The wives of prophets are sometimes made an issue of. Hosea's wife is very significant in the book of Hosea. And so sometimes the wife of a prophet has a significant role to play in his prophesying. Ezekiel's wife died, and that gave the impetus for his prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem. Hosea's wife played the harlot, and that gave the backdrop for his prophecies about how Israel had played the harlot against God. So you can see that sometimes God will use the man's wife as well as himself, even though in those cases it is not said that those prophets' wives were prophetesses. Here, I believe we are talking about Isaiah's wife, and if not, then we can allow that he may have had a concubine, that he may have taken a prophetess and made her a concubine, that we might rebel against that a little bit. But then again, like I said, in the Old Testament, concubinage was not something that was a blot on David or on Solomon or on any or on Abraham or anyone else who had concubines, or Jacob. These men had concubines. It is not a Christian practice, and it should not be practiced by Christians, but it is possible that Isaiah had a concubine here. This woman was to have a child by Isaiah, and he already knew the name. It's interesting, he took witnesses with him when he went to the prophetess's house. Now, I don't know that they witnessed everything, but they went with him just, I guess, to verify that he did this. Maybe this was to make it a legal marriage. You know, it's possible that this was how he took a concubine. Now, he already had a wife. We know that because of Shear Jashub. He had a son already living, who he took with him on the occasion of chapter 7. But if he took a concubine as a second wife here, maybe that's why he took, you know, the official witnesses, as every wedding involves witnesses. It's hard to know why witnesses would be needed otherwise, unless he was taking her as a wife, but we just can't be sure. Their names are given, apparently in case anyone wants to verify that this was a legal thing. And the woman became pregnant, and he already knew it was going to be a boy, because God said so, and he already knew the name, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Now, when his name was called that, a prophecy was uttered about him, and it says in verse 4, "Before he has knowledge, cry, my father, my mother, the riches of Damascus, and the spoil of Samaria," that's the two kingdoms that are threatening Ahaz at this moment, "shall be taken away before the king of Assyria," which we've already saw in 2 Corinthians that was fulfilled. Now, then this prophecy is given, and this prophecy, verses 5 through 7, is uttered against the northern kingdom. Now, it doesn't say so directly, but it's obviously so, because it talks about how they rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son. Certainly Ahaz didn't rejoice in those people. They were a thorn in his flesh. So it's very clear that he's talking to Israel. And he talks about how the king of Assyria is going to come and overflow his banks and you know, take them away in the flood of his military conquest. And then turning to Judah, in verse 8, he says that Assyria will also pass through Judah, and shall overflow and go over, and shall reach even to the neck. How this was fulfilled, actually, is the king of Assyria, after he wiped out Syria and Israel, came down into Judah also, and he was planning to take Jerusalem. And he took all the lower cities of Judah and defeated them. He swept like a flood through Judah, but he reached only to the neck. It's a picture of a man who submerged just up to the neck, because the head, Jerusalem, was on a hill, and it was surrounded. It's like all of Judah was captured by Assyria, but Jerusalem alone stayed above the water and untaken. And as the story goes, and it's related later in Isaiah, also in chapter 37 and 38, I think it is, that an angel of the Lord came and smote 185,000 of the Assyrians and delivered Jerusalem from that. So it's like the water came up to the neck, but didn't go over the head. The Assyrians did come against Judah, but they didn't take Jerusalem because God intervened. But in warning Judah that there will be this flood coming in of the Assyrians, in verse 8 here, he says, "And he shall stretch out his wings, he shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel." Now, who is he talking to when he says, "O Emmanuel"? He's talking to the child. This prophecy is uttered at the birth of the child, and apparently is uttered to the child, because this is something we see done elsewhere in the Scriptures. If you would just look for a moment to Luke chapter 1, which records the birth of John the Baptist. when John the Baptist was born, in Luke 1, in verse 67, it says, "And his father Zechariah was filled with the Holy Ghost and prophesied, saying, Blessed be the Lord God of Israel," and so forth. And when he gets down to verse 76, he says, "And you, child, shall be called the prophet of the highest, and you shall go before the face of the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge," etc. Now, in other words, Zechariah gave a prophecy at the birth of his son, and he addressed the prophecy to his son. He says, "You, child, will..." Now, obviously, the son couldn't understand the prophecy because he was only a baby. But it was just the manner in which the prophecy was given, as though this child was the focus of this prophecy. And in Isaiah chapter 8, Isaiah is prophesying, and as it were, it says, he's speaking to his newborn son. And he says, "Assyria is going to come and stretch its wings out and fill your land, O Emmanuel." Now he's calling his son Emmanuel, which is a name we encountered in chapter 7 and verse 14. And then he says in verse 9 and 10, "Though the enemies associate themselves and try to come against him, yet they shall not be able to succeed against Jerusalem." And it says, "They could speak the word," verse 10 says, "and it shall not stand, for God is with us." In other words, the birth of Isaiah's son conveyed the message, "God is with us," which is essentially what Emmanuel means. Now, Isaiah's son was not named Emmanuel, but then neither was Jesus. It was not an actual name given to either child at their birth. It was a nickname. It was more or less a title giving the significance of the birth of those children. When Isaiah's son was born, it was an indication that God was with him. It was a sign that the days of Syria and Israel were numbered. When Jesus was born, it was a sign that God was with us also. In fact, he was God with us in the literal sense. The prophecy of Isaiah 7:14 finds its most literal fulfillment in Jesus Christ, but there is a short-range fulfillment here. Let me show you the connections here between Isaiah chapter 7:14 and the child born in chapter 8. First of all, Isaiah's child was apparently born within the lifetime of Ahaz, and therefore could be a sign to Ahaz, as was predicted in chapter 7, that God would give him a sign. Secondly, this child, its weaning period was to be significant, just like the child in the prophecy of chapter 7. In chapter 7, remember, in verses 15 and 16, it spoke of the period of time where the child would be being weaned, and also that it would take it to become morally conscious, to have some awareness of good and evil. In the case of Isaiah's child, in chapter 8 and verse 4, it says, "Before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother," that is, before he can speak, "the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away." In other words, the prophecy about Isaiah's son is just about the same as the one about the Emmanuel child in chapter 7. Because both children are called Emmanuel, the one in chapter 8 and the one in chapter 7. Both children have a significance about their weaning period, that when they reach a certain age, it'll be the end of Syria and Samaria, Israel. So you can see that there would appear to be a natural fulfillment in chapter 8 of the prophecy of chapter 7. Does that seem fairly clear? Now you might say, "No, wait a minute, there's a few problems here. How could the birth of Isaiah's son be called a sign, when in fact it wasn't miraculous?" Whereas, of course, the birth of Jesus was miraculous because he was virgin-born, in the sense that his mother had no intercourse with a man previous to her conception. Therefore, it was a miracle, and we can see why that would be called a sign. But how could Isaiah's child's birth be called a sign? There was no miracle about it. It was just a natural union between a man and a woman that brought forth this child.